You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club, a home for those interested in international trade, shipping, procurement, logistics, and air freight. In fact, all things supply chain in the Americas, Asia, and beyond. This podcast is brought to you by your host, Mike King, and produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a global 3PL that specializes in managing logistics to, from, and within the Asia-Pacific region.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Freight Buyers Club, which, as you've just heard, is produced with the support of Demerco Express Group. I'm Mike King, and you can find this episode and many more on all podcast platforms and on YouTube, along with a bunch of shorter video interviews and news insights. You can also find all this content on www.thefreightbuyersclub.com, where you can subscribe to receive each episode direct to your inbox. Now, the global container shipping landscape from a freight buyer's perspective is about as complex right now as at any time I can think of, and that's even with the COVID era in mind. We've got the threat of new US tariffs, shipping and geopolitical risk across the Middle East and beyond, big changes in the liner shipping alliance looming into view. In the US market, we've also got the temporary closure of the Port of Baltimore, possible union action at US Gulf and East Coast ports later in the year, and we've had low water levels on the Panama Canal. And all these factors are at play while freight buyers have been negotiating trans-Pacific contracts with carriers. So I was pondering how best to get a fresh voice and some cutting-edge coverage of all this. Liner Litica is, I would say, the coming force in container market intelligence, providing some searingly relevant graphics to support its analysis. Its founder is very well known for often taking a different line of market developments than many of his peers. He also doesn't do many interviews. Huayu Tan, welcome to the Freight Buyers Club. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Mike. There is a lot to cover on the container shipping markets right now, so let's get right into your questions.
Absolutely. But before we get started, just to let you all know, the YouTube version of this interview will feature some really insightful Linalytica graphics that bring to life the topics we're examining today. So I would really urge you to check that out if you want more detail and depth as you listen along to this chat. But with all of that out of the way, I agree, let's get straight into it and let's start with freight rates. Trans-Pacific contract negotiations have been dragging on quite some time. It's a fascinating market this year. So just to open things up then, where are we now in terms of the sorts of levels BCOs are signing those contracts at per FEU? And how does this compare to spot rates? And also, how does all this look compared to what lines were originally asking for and those pricing levels signed a year ago?
Right. We are right now in the last week of April as we are recording this. But as usual, negotiations are going down to the wire. So it will be a busy week for the final contracts to be concluded before the end of April. Now, if we look at the situation now, it is very different this year compared to where we were 12 months ago. If we compare where the market stood back in April of 2023, you will see that spot rates at that time were dipping going into April, and the carriers were largely unable to push the rates up ahead of the rate negotiations. So they entered the bargaining season last year in a rather weak position. So last year, the contract rates were done at around the $1,400 level per FEU to the US West Coast. But even at that rate, a lot of these contracts were renegotiated to a lower level as the year progressed because the spot rates dropped further in the summer of last year. And so we ended up with a very low base at the beginning of this year. Now, the situation is very different this year because the carriers are coming to the negotiating table on a much stronger position. We have spot rates rising as a result of the Red Sea situation since December. And even though the spot rates have corrected slightly since February, they remain substantially higher compared to where we were 12 months ago. But at this point, I think it's also important to be clear that there isn't a single benchmark rate in the market right now because there is a very wide range of rates out in the market with very different price tiers depending on the volumes of business that you can bring in. But generally, I would say that the contract rates for this year is around 10 to 20% higher compared to where we were last year. And so for a large BCO, that would be in the $1,400 per FEU range. And for a smaller or medium-sized BCO, we would be looking at around the $1,600 per FEU range. That's rates to the US West Coast. And as for rates to the East Coast, it will be around $1,000 higher than the West Coast rates. At this point, I am seeing traction around this $1,600 benchmark rate. And there is a strong incentive for freight buyers to sign at this level, if only because this level still represents a big discount compared to where we are on the spot market currently. If you go out and buy in the spot market, we would still be looking at around the $26,000 to $3,000 level. So if you can sign at a rate that is at a significant discount to where spot rates are at the moment, I think that incentive is high. So, you know, although the carriers did not quite get the larger increase that they were initially looking for, I am seeing that the contracts are closing with a small increase. Plus, there's still potential for additional rate hikes as we get into the peak season. So if you're looking at this from the carrier's perspective, it's not all bad at the moment.
Maybe more upturn in the months ahead then. In terms of those disruptions or forward risks on those Asia to North America services, obviously, as you mentioned, the big challenge is the Red Sea crisis, which really has jolted shipping markets with some force by more or less closing the Suez Canal to container traffic. This had a big impact on overall supply and also transit times into the US East Coast, which obviously has come into those spot markets, which has then softened again after the initial jolt. What we see now is this lines and shippers have adjusted to this. And are they planning for these Red Sea diversions to potentially remain part of the shipping picture for the rest of this year or maybe even longer?
Yes. So the big game changer here is, of course, the Red Sea. And it's such a big game changer because it has had a large and immediate impact on overall vessel supply. We have now 5 million TEUs of vessel capacity that's been diverted to the Cape of Good Hope since the end of December last year. And that number has remained roughly constant for the past 4 months. And in effective terms, this 5 million TEUs that are now on the Cape of Good Hope has effectively removed around 6 to 8% of the global fleet. And the 6 to 8% removal of supply is a significant number. And although about 15 to 20% of these diversions are for ships going to and from the US East Coast, that number is actually decreasing. I'm referring to the ships that are going to the East Coast. It is decreasing slightly, mainly because the Panama situation is improving. So some of these ships are going back to Panama. The bigger impact is going to be on Europe, but even more so to Med, because the transit time difference between going through the Suez versus going through the Cape is a lot larger if you're going to the Med. And so this is where I see freight rates will remain highly elevated for the next couple of months, more so in the Med, but also to a large extent spilling over to Northern Europe as well. Now, these diversions to the Cape has essentially erased all of the surplus capacity that's available in the market. And again, I cannot emphasize enough that this has been the key game changer for us this year as we get into the peak season, because the glut of excess capacity that we had initially expected to come this year, we now have instead a significant shortage of ships in the market instead. Now, there is a significant evidence of this container capacity shortage right now. If you look at the container ship charter rates, you will see that rates have been rising since the end of last year, again coinciding with the Red Sea crisis. And even though we have seen freight rates correcting somewhat since February, on the container charter rates, it is still rising. And what that shows is that there is still significant unmet demand on the charter markets. And that points again to a shortage of ships in the market. The other piece of evidence that we have at this point is the significant decline in the idle capacity. You will see from the chart that I'm sharing here that we are almost completely out of idle ships in the market, and we're almost back to the same levels as where we were in 2020 to 2022 during the peak of the COVID crisis.
As you say, Waju, it's an interesting start to 2024, because if you went back 6 months, the idea that we'd be talking about a shortage of container ships would have been ludicrous. 2024 was clearly going to be an excess supply story, but it's flipped on its head. And I will come back to that supply picture, because what happens in Suez really is the joker in the pack in terms of that supply-demand balance. But let's stick on the Middle East, if we may. Risk has increased further in the region after Iran seized the MS Aries near the UAE, which has put shipping safety in the Strait of Hormuz and the Arabian Gulf, the Persian Gulf, as many people call it, in doubt. How does this change things for shipping, do you think? There's a lot of shippers using sea air options out of Dubai to avoid transits of the Cape at the moment, particularly those in South Asia. But obviously, there's some big markets in the Gulf in its own right as well, isn't there?
Yeah, I think it's important to put the numbers in context, because of the over 500 container ships that are currently trading in the Persian Gulf, only 10 out of these 500 ships are owned by Israeli-linked interests. And this includes the MSC Aries, which has now been detained by Iran. And all of these Israeli-linked ships are operated by a single operator, which is MSC. So in terms of the percentage of the fleet that's operating in that region, the Israeli-linked fleet accounts for less than 2% of all ships in the Persian Gulf right now. And again, I'm referring here to all container ships only. And so as of last week, MSC has already taken steps to divert all of these Israeli-linked ships away from the Persian Gulf. The redeployment of these ships will have some small impact on the cargo that's already loaded on board. But given that the numbers are small, the disruption is fairly minimal at this point, and I do not expect that this will have a significant impact on the trade in the Persian Gulf at this time. So unless we have a full-scale blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, that is if the Iran-Israeli conflict escalates further, and I'm not ruling this out at all, but at this point in time, traffic in the Persian Gulf is still open, and there is no container ships that can be directly linked to Israel available in the area at the moment. So I would have to say that the risk is largely minimized for now, at least.
Let's slip back to the US. There's a few other risks or disruptions playing on people's shipping and logistics decisions too. We've had this year and end of last year, low water on the Panama Canal. Now that seems to be improving at the moment. We've also got the threat of dock worker union action later this year when the current deal between the International Longshoremen's Association and East Coast and Gulf Coast port and carrier interests represented by the United States Maritime Alliance expires at the end of September. And then we've got the closure of Baltimore port due to the Dali incident, which has also tightened up capacity at some of those East Coast ports, which are now taking the strain of that volume. How important are all these various factors in terms of playing into shipping strategies into the US? And does this favor US West Coast port options, or are we overstating that a little bit?
Right. The Panama Canal situation was indeed an issue at the end of last year, and it was at its worst in December when the new Panamax booking slots for Panama Canal transits was cut by one third. And so the number of transits came down quite drastically. But the good news here is that the Panama Canal situation is normalizing somewhat. And we have gotten back some of the transit slots since December. So the situation is improving. And I do expect that by the beginning of June, there will be additional new Panamax transit slots that will become available. And there will be sufficient slots to meet the demand from the container ship sector at least. Although, you know, some of the other shipping sectors could still be short. So as far as the Panama Canal factor is concerned, it's less of a challenge this year, or at least until we come to the next drought that might come along, but nobody really can predict that. The Baltimore situation is also quite manageable. If you look at the share of Baltimore across all of the main East Coast ports, Baltimore only handles 4.5% of the overall container volumes in the U.S. East Coast. And so the closure of the port can be accommodated by moving the cargo to the neighboring ports, especially to New York and Norfolk. New York handles around 31% of total East Coast volumes, and Norfolk handles 13%. And so there is a sufficient capacity available at the moment to handle the Baltimore diversions. And indeed, that's exactly what's happened since the Baltimore bridge incident. We have not seen any significant buildup of congestion at the East Coast ports since the Baltimore incident. And I expect that the situation will remain manageable in the coming weeks, at least until the Port of Baltimore can be reopened again. On the last part, I think the East Coast dock worker contracts, that's a completely different situation altogether. If you look at the share of East Coast versus West Coast cargo split for containers coming into the U.S., you will see that the East Coast share has been rising quite significantly, and this is coming at the expense of the West Coast ports. And this has been especially significant in the last 3 years. If you compare the situation back 10, 15 years ago, the West Coast share had more than 65%, or around two-thirds of the overall U.S. inbound cargo volumes would have been channeled through the West Coast ports. But over the last decade or so, you will see that this share has been falling, and it dropped to a all-time low at the end of 2022. And that was at the height of the ILWU contract negotiations. And at that time, the West Coast share dropped below 50%. As of last year, the West Coast has regained some of the share that it's lost. Its share of the total inbound cargo into the U.S. is now slightly above 50% again. But I do expect that the West Coast will regain some of the share that it lost in the last few years, especially given the ILA contract negotiations that will develop over the coming months. But at this point, I think it's still early in the negotiations, and we shall have to watch this space closely in the months to come.
Okay, that's certainly one to watch. There's another major factor that we need to keep an eye on, and that's November elections in the US. Donald Trump is threatening a huge wave of new tariffs, especially on Chinese imports. In theory, these tariffs could be up and running before the current round of annual Transpac contracts are finished, sort of May, June next year. Is this the game changer it seems to be, or is this more of a consideration for those taking a long-term or medium-term view of where they source their cargo?
Now, if there is any lesson to be learned from the first Trump administration's tariffs on China, it is this: tariffs do not work. Because if we look at the U.S. trade imbalance since 2018, when the tariffs were first introduced, you will see that U.S. container imports have continued to rise. Of course, it peaked during the COVID period, but even post-COVID, you will see that total imports in 2023 is still higher compared to imports in 2017. And so as far as the tariffs are concerned, it has done nothing to reduce the volume of imports coming into the U.S. But look at what has happened to the U.S. exports. You will see that U.S. exports has in fact shrank. So not only has there been zero gains in U.S. exports since 2018, but actual export numbers that's moving in containers today are actually lower compared to any point in the past 10 years. So if you look at the intention of having tariffs in the first place, and if the goal was to promote U.S. exports and to reduce the U.S. trade imbalance, then very clearly this has failed to achieve what it set up to attain. But having said that, I don't think that this is going to deter politicians from continuing with such policies. And I would certainly not rule out another round of tariffs if they do come. This will certainly create some disruptions for the container markets. There will be winners and losers in such cases. But in my view, I think the US is going to be worse off.
Well, we'll see how that political debate goes. It doesn't seem like the actual facts sometimes make it into all parts of the media over in the US in terms of what tariffs have achieved or not achieved, as you point out there with very clear statistics. Just looking at the demand side in the US, there's mixed messages, essentially. We're hearing that demand for warehousing or industrial warehousing is relatively bearish. But then on the other side, we've got Descartes and others calling big increases in US box imports year on year, up 21% in March, in fact. Some of that was to do with the date of Lunar New Year shutdowns this year compared to 2023, which does skew things, but the numbers for Q1 are definitely up. The Global Port Tracker report from the National Retailer Federation and Hackett's is predicting big year-on-year increases for most of this year, in fact. So what's going on? And certainly in the first half of this year, are we seeing people shipping earlier? Or is this an economy performing better than most expected? Or are consumers just, they just can't stop spending? What's going on?
Yeah, I think it's important to look at the first quarter growth in context here. So while it is true that we've had over 20% growth overall in container volumes into the US in the first quarter, this is coming against a very weak first quarter in 2023. So the volumes this year is actually normalizing after that huge buildup of excess inventories that we saw back in 2022 and the subsequent destocking shock that we saw in the early part of 2023. And in fact, if we look at actual volumes, you will see that the cargo volumes have already started to normalize since the second half of last year. So as we get to the middle of this year, around June, July, you will see that the very high growth rates that we saw in the earlier part of this year, those numbers will start to taper off again. But that's not necessarily a negative. What it means is that we are back to a more normalized growth phase after the very dramatic gains and losses that we saw in the previous 3 years. And again, I would caution against reading too much into the exuberance that some analysts might see in the first quarter numbers. But there is also another very interesting point that I want to make here. Overall, U.S. imports from Asia is actually higher today, not just in 2022 and 2021 at the peak of COVID, but today, the actual volumes coming into the U.S. is higher compared to 2017 and 2018. And so again, to my point earlier, the import tariffs hasn't really worked in reducing that trade imbalance. But what's interesting to see here is that the composition of the import origins has also shifted quite dramatically. Vietnam has been the clear winner out of all this because they gain largely at the expense of China. But outside of these two countries, outside of Vietnam and China, there really has been very little change in the share of the other main Asian export origins. So if you look at places like Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, even Bangladesh, You will see that these countries has not really gained very much at all from the US-China trade war. And also, I think it's interesting to have a quick word here on nearshoring, because even though the most recent data would suggest that Mexico has gained significantly in trade volumes with the US, I think that a large part of that is really Chinese origin cargo that's going through Mexico. And so again, to my earlier point, I think that the trade tariffs that the US imposed has certainly also introduced a lot of distortions on the composition of the container trade. But in terms of actually achieving the results that it sets out to accomplish, I see very little evidence that they are actually working.
We'll just take a short break. We'll be back with you in a second.
This podcast is proudly produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a trusted provider of global shipping and contract logistics services in Asia, Europe, and North America. Demerco's particular strength is in Asia, where it gives shippers the freight capacity and local market expertise to streamline freight movements to and from the region, particularly for trans-Pacific lanes. With 130 forwarding and logistics locations across China, India, and Southeast Asia, Demerco connects Asia with the world like no other global 3PL. You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club.
Okay, ship supply. Do you have any numbers or forecasts for capacity increases across the industry this year, just in terms of that overall fleet?
Yes. So overall new container ship supply that's going to be delivered this year will exceed 3 million TEUs. And as of the first 4 months of the year, we are very much on track to hit this 3 million TEU number. In percentage terms, this 3 million TEUs will translate to a net growth of over 9% even after adjusting for scrapping. So in terms of ship supply, we do have a considerable number of new ships that we have to contend with.
And with those sort of delivery levels, presumably, if everything stays equal, we'll see some downward pressure on spot rates. Obviously, there's a lot of other factors in there, though.
Yeah, the good news is that the Red Sea has taken up all of the excess tonnage so far. So as I pointed out earlier, there is a shortage of ships in the market, at least for now. And this situation, I expect, is going to last at least until the end of the summer, which will take us through October. So as I said before, the Red Sea situation has been an absolute game changer for the industry, and it has turned the supply and demand equation completely upside down. I think that some of the more bearish analysts have been overly negative in calling for a far larger correction in freight rates this year. And I think the carriers themselves have been equally guilty of this, because I believe that they've been overly conservative in their earnings guidance for this year. If you follow what Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd and some of the other carriers have said about their earnings projections for this year, I think that it is unnecessarily negative. To be clear, we haven't seen rates collapse to pre-Red Sea levels right now, like what some of the analysts had suggested previously. And in fact, we have seen some recent strengths in freight rates on a few trade lanes. For example, to Latin America, we have seen rates rebound very strongly for cargo from Asia to South America in the past month. And I also expect to see that the carriers will get some of the rate hikes that they're pushing for in May. So again, I don't see it as all doom and gloom for this year. And again, we have the Red Sea crisis to thank for all this.
Okay, and what happens if there's a resolution to the Red Sea crisis and the Suez Canal opens up again, just in theory?
Now, of course, if that happens, we will have a complete collapse in freight rates, a complete reversal again of this supply and demand situation. Because once one or two of the main carriers go back to the Suez, the rest of the market will simply have to follow. So when that happens, what we will see is that 6 to 8% that's been diverted to the Cape will then go back to the market, and that new capacity coming back to the market within a very short span of time will cause an immediate collapse in freight rates. I just don't see how this can be stopped. So when that happens, of course, carriers' earnings will completely crash, and we are going to go back to the fourth quarter 23 scenario again. When you see lines starts to report massive losses, only this time it's going to be worse because of that huge supply overhang. But having said all that, I do not expect to see a quick resolution to the Middle East crisis. And again, my base case is that this crisis in the Red Sea is going to drag out for many more months and perhaps even turn into a multi-year issue. So this is a scenario that I think the market needs to prepare for as well.
Just in terms of how the markets or the lines are preparing for next year, obviously there's this big question mark about Suez, but we've also got some changes to the alliance system. Do you think the current lineup that we've got for 2025, is that settled now, or is there still more scope for some changes?
Yeah, I definitely see room for more changes to come. Because firstly, I think the alliance game of musical chairs has not ended. If we look at the balance of power between the four new alliances, what is glaring if you compare the four new alliances is the alliance is lacking in relation to its rivals in terms of skill. And that's going to set them back materially as a serious contender in the market, and they have to plug that gap. So the first change that I would expect is that the alliance will have to come up with a solution for that gap in the capacity imbalance to be plugged. So far, the only thing that the alliance carriers have hinted at is some form of collaboration with possibly one or two of the fringe carriers. But that really isn't a long-term solution, because if you add either a One High or SM line to the alliance, that will not really move the needle very much for them, especially on the Asia, Europe, and the transatlantic markets, because these fringe carriers are not even involved in that market at all. The addition of these smaller new members will only cover some of the gaps on the Trans-Pacific, but the Trans-Pacific is really the least of the alliance concern at this point. So I would expect that there has to be some more changes to come, and that could perhaps involve some tie-up with one or more of the existing alliance carriers, and this could be in the form of slot swaps or potentially also some joint services. That will not be a full-fledged alliance arrangement. Now, the second change that I would expect to come is how the carriers are going to deal with the capacity raise, because the formation of Gemini, I think, has already started to trigger off a response from some of the rivals. And again, I see that each of the main carriers will have to continue to build scale as one of their core objectives. And this was a capacity raise that Maersk started back in 2011 when they first set out to build the Triple E ships. But that lead has since been taken over by MSC after Maersk decided to switch strategy in 2016. You will see already some of the responses coming from the smaller carriers. In this case, three of them has already announced some fairly aggressive expansion plans. And I see that, you know, this response is going to be inevitable, especially for those that have lagged behind the rest of the market. So if you look at the three carriers that's come up so far, that's ONE, HMM, and Hapag-Lloyd. They've all announced significant new investments between now until 2030. But what's common amongst these three is that all of these three carriers have been lagging behind the rest of the market since 2016. And what they're doing now is basically trying to catch up with the rest of the market. I see also a risk if MERS decides to join them, because MERS certainly is, again, one of the laggards in the market. And it would be interesting to see if they will also switch to a expansionist mode at some point in the future. So to your question, my take is that there's going to be a lot more changes to come. And the next 2 years, we'll see a lot of market action. So that's something that we also have to keep watch on.
Just for our listeners, the Gemini cooperation, right? So this is the new Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd partnership. It starts operations early next year. I love to finish a podcast on a hub and spoke system. So it was a perfect link in for me. They do plan to use a hub and spoke setup to deliver schedule reliability of something over 90%, they're promising. It's quite a claim considering 60% schedule reliability is a bit of a rarity for carriers at the moment, or even over the last few years. So are you a big fan of hub and spoke systems? Can this work?
Right. There really isn't anything to be a fan of here. There is a time and place where a hub and spoke system would work. But there will also be situations where this type of network does not work well. And so we really need to look at it and recognize it for what it does. I think the first important point to point out here is that we have had hub and spoke systems since the very early days of container shipping. So this is not a new idea at all. And for those of you old enough to remember the liner conference system, we had in the past freight rates pricing that are based on base port rates plus transport additionals for outports. And this base port and outport system was built around the hub and spoke system, and that has been around since the 1970s. So again, there's nothing that's new or novel about this system at all. Now, as the container market evolved and volumes grew, some of these outports became base ports as they received direct calls. So today, we now see direct calls at ports such as in Thailand and Vietnam, for example. And we see also in places in Europe, places like Poland and Italy that used to be outports in the past, but they are now today part of the direct port system. So once these former feeder ports becomes direct ports, it is very hard to roll back the clock and for carriers to go back to a hub and spoke system, I think is going to be a problem. I think that we don't need to go very far back to see the last serious attempt to switch back to a pure hub and spoke system. And that is in 2011, when Maersk rolled out the Daily Maersk product for those who were in the market at that point. Now, the Daily Maersk product that Maersk introduced in 2011, that was a pure hub and spoke service because it had only 4 main ports in Asia and 3 ports in Europe. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, the Daily Maersk service did not last very long. There is a long list of reasons behind why that product failed. But I think the main problem here is that, firstly, the market isn't going to pay a premium for the improved reliability that such a product is supposed to produce. And also, the second big problem here is that the spoke system, meaning that the feeder network that you would have to operate as part of that system, that comes at a cost because your transit times and schedule reliability, although it's good on the hub ports, it's going to be worse off on the out ports. On top of that, it's an expensive network to maintain because you need to have an extensive feeder network to keep that system going. So as far as the Gemini network is concerned, I think that the hub and spoke approach is really a poor man's response to a fuller product that their rivals could deliver in the market, which Gemini cannot deliver right now because they don't have the scale and they don't have the ships available to provide a fuller range of direct port calls. So if you look more closely at the Gemini network, you will see a lot of gaps in their port coverage. So for example, on the Asia-Europe network, there is no direct calls in many key ports. For example, nothing in Le Havre, nothing in Antwerp, nothing in Southampton, nothing in Gdansk. And if you look at Asia, there is also no direct port calls in key main ports like Busan, nothing in North China, nothing in South China other than Yantian, and certainly nothing also in Vietnam and even places like Taiwan, there is no direct calls. So I think that this is going to be a problem for Gemini to compete effectively with their rivals. I think it's also going to be a problem on the Trans-Pacific. If you look at the Gem network on the Trans-Pacific, it actually has a very weak Trans-Pacific product, especially going into the US West Coast. It doesn't have direct connections between South China to the Pacific Northwest, for example, a very limited coverage of places like Vietnam. And in terms of total number of services, it has only 4 weekly sailings to the West Coast. That's a very small number of direct sailings to the West Coast, because if you compare against the rivals, Ocean Alliance has at least 13 such sailings, and D Alliance will have 10. So even with a weakened D Alliance, they are going to have a significantly superior product to the US West Coast compared to what Gemini has to offer. So again, if you look at the reason behind why Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd is going for a hub-and-spoke approach, it is my belief that it's not because that approach, that hub-and-spoke network, is a superior product compared to the more diverse and connected network that their rivals can offer. I think it has more to do with their lack of skill. Again, if you look at the rate of growth that Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd has achieved since 2017, it should be clear that these two carriers are amongst the slowest growing carriers if you compare the carriers in the top 10 list. And this difference is especially stark if you compare the growth of Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd to the growth of MSC, especially over this last 5 years. And so when you don't have the scale to mount a full-fledged network, then the next best thing for both Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd is to come up with the next best solution, which is this limited hub-and-spoke network. But I think that this is going to serve as a catalyst for the next stage of market disruptions. There's certainly going to be a lot of changes in the next couple of years. There is a lot more that we can cover, but I think we have to leave that for some other time.
That was a fascinating breakdown of Gemini. It breaks it down very, very, very clearly. And I do actually remember covering the Daily Maersk, which was launched to huge fanfare and then quietly shelved later on. And as you mentioned, if people don't pay for schedule reliability, then they're not going to get it. But we'll come back to this hopefully later in the year, because that was a brilliant breakdown of the container market by the founder of Linealytica, Huaju Tan. Thank you so much for coming on to the Freight Buyers Club.
Again, thank you, Mike.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Freight Buyers Club, produced in partnership with the Demerco Express Group. Please subscribe and follow on your platform of choice, or sign up for delivery to your inbox at thefreightbuyersclub.com. This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the fantastic editing of Karen Ball and Tom Matthews. And finally, thank you all for listening. The next episode will be with you soon.